the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Hello, I am your host, Athena Melville, and I welcome you to Education Now. In this May 17th edition, we talk with Mike Lonza, MAED and MBA from Stanford, chief blogger at Playberhood.com, which he started in 2007, and the author of the book Playberhood, Turn Your Neighborhood into a Place for Play. Mike Lonza is an expert on the subject of kids and kids play in neighborhoods, and he has worked hard to create a very rich neighborhood play life for his three boys, ages 7, 4, and 2, in Menlo Park, California. Mike has also discovered and written about dozens of neighborhoods throughout North America that are doing innovative things to make a vibrant life for kids. Prior to his writing career, Mike was a 5-time software and internet entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. So let's get started with the interview. And remember, you can always send comments to me at hermes@pacific.net or join us on our Education Now Facebook page or our Education Now Google Plus page. So here we go with Playberhood and Mike Lonza. Hello, Mike Lonza, and welcome to Education Now.
Hello, Athena.
I've told our listeners in the introduction to this interview that you hold an MA in education, an MBA, and an MA MBA in economics.
Too many degrees.
And they're all from Stanford University. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And you're the chief blogger at Playberhood.com, which you started in 2007.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And I just published a book called Playberhood as well. It just came out this past month.
Right, and that's what we want to talk about. I want to be sure, before we end this interview, that you tell everyone how they can get a hold of the book Playberhood, Turn Your Neighborhood into a Place for Play. Can you tell us what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I guess we should go back to when my oldest son, I have three boys, 7, 4, and 2. Right before my oldest son was born, I started talking to friends of mine who had kids. Really, for the first time since I was a kid, really started paying attention to what kids' lives are like. Because I had been a single adult in San Francisco doing the dating thing and concentrating on my career, and I was amazed, absolutely amazed, that these days parents say kids don't play outside, and in particular they don't play independently of adults outside. What we call play today is often is. When parents are watching over kids, they're playing organized ball, they're playing video games inside the home. But to me, when I was a kid, playing was playing with my friends with no adults around in the neighborhood and really exploring and learning and having the best time. Those are all my best childhood memories. And back then, when my son Marco was about to be born, I said right there, I'm not doing this. I'm not raising my kids the way that other kids are being raised in American society today. I want to do it differently. Not necessarily to turn back the clock, but I believe that it's a fundamental right of children to play independently on their own. Not just anywhere, not far away from the home, but right in the neighborhood, in a place where they know neighbors, they know neighbor kids, and parents know, we know neighbors and neighbor kids. It's a, like a village, a place where they can be comfortable but learn how to be independent.
So what drove your passion to become an expert in the subject of children's play was really having your own, well, you have three children, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's what drove the passion.
Absolutely. You know, and it's, I guess you could also say that in my career I've been an entrepreneur, a Silicon Valley software and internet entrepreneur. And when I get a bug up, you know, to do something, I really dive into it very, very deeply, and I don't accept that, you know, this can't be done or that can't be done. It started, you know, I started by thinking, oh, I'll just buy a house in a neighborhood where kids play and problem will be solved. And it was, I couldn't find it. I kept driving around asking, and the more I asked, the more I looked, the more I realized that the culture of childhood in America has very, very much changed since I was a kid. And to give my kids the kind of life that I want, I was going to have to work really hard at it. And I think I'd like to say, fortunately for other parents out there, I figured out some things so that they may not have to spend as much time as I have on it.
Right. I know when my own four sons, who are now adults in their 30s and 40s, were growing up in Southern California, friends and I noticed that everything was being bought up to make the track homes, and spaces weren't being left for the children. And so we created these things called adventure playgrounds, and we would fill them up with tools and, you know, wood, and then just let the kids have at it. And they created some amazing place, you know, play there, but it was supervised. And by that I mean that there was an adult there who followed the children, which is a Montessori concept, follow the child.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not unsupervised, because I think what they learned from the free schools in England was that what happens in a situation where there's no adult responsible and observing is that there'll be a child with a really strong personality who will take control. And so this is why I don't want to go so far that we move into that free school idea. And by free, I mean freedom without responsibility is license.
Mm-hmm.
But that the children are, you know, you're following their desire, their wishes, their lead, but you're there if there needs to be limits.
Well, you know, the neighborhood is really child's neighborhood is really a magical place. It's very unique in that, yes, there are parents around, and anybody can just look outside their window and just check in and see what's going on. I'm not talking about kids, you know, going to a schoolyard a mile or two away and we don't know what's happening. I mean, I think that's good eventually for kids to grow into that.
Yes.
But for young kids, if they're doing it right outside your front door, I think it's good for parents to pull back a little bit and realize that their kids are right there. And I would like to think that that one set of parents knows that the other parents are somewhere around, or nannies or babysitters are around and looking out and checking in every so often.
Yes.
But fundamentally, for a parent to be there all the time changes the nature of what kids do. It's like, you know, in physics and quantum mechanics, I forget it, there's a certain principle that says that if you observe something, you change it. And while I don't think that parents are bad, I think that there's a lot that kids learn when they feel like they're on their own. And I think that's really important.
Yes, I think that... I think that when children know that the person who is there, they can trust not to interfere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That changes.
And somehow they have to feel like that person's not there in some sense. You know, not that they feel unsafe, but they have to feel like, yeah, I can try this. I can try that.
Oh, yeah.
I can take risks.
Yeah. Yes, and a good facilitator allows for that. Well, we can just leave that there now and come back to it. Are there other, have you noticed that there are other neighborhoods in North America that are doing what you're trying to do there?
Well, you know, yeah, obviously I didn't come up with the idea of playing in neighborhoods. It's been around for a long time, and it hasn't totally vanished from American society. I found many great neighborhoods that, you know, never heard of Playborhood until I contacted them, that have been doing some really great things, and I want to learn from them. So I've traveled throughout the United States checking out these neighborhoods and written about them in my book, Playborhood. A couple that I'll mention quickly, I've written about, I think, about a dozen of them in the book. One is a co-housing community in Davis, California. Co-housing, for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, is it's kind of like a communal living where people really live together and have some meals together and do things together, but everybody owns their own home. So, you know, when you walk inside your door, you can invite people in, but you own your home. What's interesting about co-housing is you know, this mix. People who live there own their own home, but they have a common backyard. They have a common house where they have meals with each other three or four times a week. And the place that I speak of in Davis, California, called N Street, is unique because architects didn't come and say, well, we're going to build a co-housing community. It's actually in a neighborhood just like a lot of other neighborhoods in Davis, California, or anywhere else in the United States, except neighbors started to tear down fences between their homes, and they decided to start having dinner together. And now they have a co-housing community with about 60 people. And as you know, it's great for adults, but it's especially great for kids who have actually pretty small houses there. But they have a huge backyard with a trampoline and a playhouse and an organic garden and a little pond, and they have kids to play with all the time. They're never bored. They always have someone to play with. So that's one place that I think is really interesting, very unique.
Yes, I love Davis, California. And so they found a way to create community as well as creating this space for the children to be together, a neighborhood. I know that a lot of people tell me they don't feel safe letting their children go outside, which is so sad, you know, thinking that their child's going to be taken, right?
Well, we could talk statistics, but statistics actually don't persuade too many people. The statistics are, in general, first of all, that abductions of children where a stranger comes to your neighborhood, we call him a predator, and he or she, usually a he, almost always a he, and takes your child away is extremely rare.
Yes.
Abductions that result in death of the child number around 50 per year in the United States. And it's such a small number that, you know, you're more likely of being struck by lightning. You're much more likely to have a lot of things happen to you. It's so small that the U.S. government has stopped tracking the statistic. They actually don't know exactly the number because it's such a small phenomenon, but it actually drives a lot of parents' actions. You're actually approximately 50, your child is actually 50 times more likely to be killed in an automobile accident than to be killed at the hands of a predator. So
yeah.
The least safe thing you can do with your child every day is to put them in a car and drive them, but pretty much every parent does that.
That's right. And I know in places like Palo Alto, in order to get the kind of philosophy of education that every parent wanted for their child, then they have all these different schools, but then you can't walk to your school. All these kids are being driven to the
right.
Schools.
We're fortunate. My family was fortunate to be able to choose our neighborhood, to buy a home in a neighborhood where we want to live. I know not everybody's able to do that, but for those families who are, I have a chapter in Playborhood about moving and choosing your neighborhood, and very definitely, I believe that you should choose your neighborhood, choose your school district. If you think the school district is good enough, have your kids go to that neighborhood school and walk or ride there. My oldest son, who's in first grade, He rides his bike to and from school every day, a mile and a half each way, and he rides with me usually in the morning, but in the afternoon coming home, he rides on his own. And that may seem remarkable to parents of first graders, but if you think about it, kids did it decades ago. There's nothing genetically or physiologically that keeps kids from being able to do that. It's really this what I consider strange cultural bias against it. Kids can do it, and it's really great for Marco. And he not only goes to and from school, sometimes he'll go somewhere else after school. Like he's meeting me on Friday in downtown Menlo Park, California, for a haircut. So he's not going straight home. He's going a different route, yeah. And he can do that.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's just wonderful. The movement that is being taken from so many children, you know, they're even cutting recess, less and less free playtime for imagination and exploration. And that's happening everywhere. And it's wonderful that you have the option to create this environment for your children. It's movement and brain development are so closely connected that it's a crime what's happening to many children. Well, talk to us about the concept of marrying the neighborhood you live in.
Sure. Well, I originally came up with the notion of marrying your neighborhood in describing how to find a home, find a neighborhood to move to if you're moving. But it applies equally well once you live there. I guess I go back, the foundation for that idea is our marriages between a man and woman where, one of the people who's being married is from a traditional society. I'm Italian-American and my wife is Chinese and we both have a tradition in our cultures of not just marrying the person, marrying the whole family. And very definitely my wife's parents are at our house every day, and I help. And they just bought a house two blocks away from us, and that's wonderful. We see them all the time, and so I didn't just marry my wife; I married her parents, and by extension, her extended family. So I really believe that when you buy a house, and then once you're there, you need to think not just of the four walls of your house or just the boundaries of your property, but who else lives there, and realize that you're not going to love everybody who's there, but they're a part of your extended family. These people are people who, you know, there's potential playmates for your children there. They're people who might watch over your children. They're people who might reprimand your children if they're doing something wrong. I actually hope that they do. I hope that they can sort of extend the reach of parenting beyond my wife and I and our babysitters. That's good. And not that you're going to love everybody, but this is an extended family. And if you think of it that way, when you move, you're going to choose people who you want to be around you. You're not going to know exactly everything about them, but you want your kids to be around other kids. You want your kids to be around people who make an investment of being outside and being in the neighborhood rather than people who just jump in the car and drive away and never talk to anybody. So that's the basic idea.
Right. It takes a community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's particularly important for children. You know, don't forget children, you know, it's obvious, but people don't think about it. Children are not allowed to drive, and there's good reason why they're not allowed to drive. So for children to have sort of their own domain, for children to have control over their own lives, it has to be right outside their front door. Because once you put them in a car, you're strapping them in. They can't move. They're looking at the back of your head. And by the way, it's the most dangerous thing they'll do all day, which I said before. But you're exerting power over them. You're taking them where you want to go. And then once you're there, adults, parents are hovering over kids the entire time. But in the neighborhood, that's the place. That's their domain. That's the place they can explore. So if you don't give your kids that, then they don't have anywhere really.
Yes. Well, when we moved from Southern California, where we were in Huntington Beach was becoming the fastest growing community in America, and we moved up to Northern California into the woods, and my children just had so much fun. It was just wonderful. to be in nature and to be exploring and learning at the same time, and that freedom and walking and just, oh, it's just wonderful. And of course, when they were really young, we did have these seatbelt laws, which I understand why they're important. But so in the back of the station wagon, man, they just had a blast. And
I did too.
Yeah, so you know.
Yeah.
Now, are you recommending that you keep screens like televisions and computers and video games off until the kids go to bed?
Well, you know, what I do in my life is probably beyond what I would recommend to people. People, you know, I do realize we live in the 21st century, and television, internet, video games are an important part of our culture. But if you can, geez, you know, well, absolutely. I guess strong recommendation to back what the American Pediatric Association has said. No screens before the age of two, zero. And then after that, if you can, you keep them away. We started when our first son was growing up, and you know, we weren't chomping at the bit when he turned two to get a television, and we just haven't had a television, and he's now 7 and a half, almost 8 years old, and I'm confident that he has a better childhood than kids who are sitting in front of screens every day. That's not to say, you know, I get back to what I said, it's part of our culture, it's important, so our kids do, you know, We'll show them a video here or there. We have an iPad, and when we go on vacation, they'll watch the iPad. It helps when we're trying to sit in a seat on the airplane. And when they get older, it's going to be an important part of their social life to be on Facebook and to have cell phones. I understand that. But when they're young, they're getting their habits for how they interact with the world. And I want them to have the foundation to know that the real world is their world. That is the most important place, not any virtual world. I want them to be ingrained with the idea that conversation face-to-face with people is far more important than anything you could do typing on a keyboard. And it horrifies me when I see kids sitting next to each other playing a video game with each other, not looking at each other, or texting to each other or to other people when they're sitting right next to each other. They're going to start using screens. They're going to start using these media, but absolutely not when they're little kids. Absolutely not.
Yes, we didn't have television. We would rent videos. But I felt that that was a great family experience. Watching a video together was like reading a book as a family.
Well, the great thing about non-live television, you know, like videos,
right,
is you have the remote in your hand. And what we do, I have shown some videos to my kids. Like for instance, Apollo 13 is one of our favorite things to watch. We've watched it probably 3 or 4 times. And I stop it every minute or two, and it becomes a great vehicle for conversation.
Yes.
And so it actually enhances our face-to-face experience.
Yes.
Rather than detracting from it. And then we go and we learn more about the outer space. But the idea that you're planting your kids in front of a TV and you let them go, I just think is totally backwards.
Yeah, I think that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think you should let kids go when they play. But when they're in front of a television, it's tempting because they get entranced. They can sit there for a long time, but that's exactly the wrong time to let them go. That's
right.
When you need to have the remote. You need to stop and talk about things.
Yeah, you're using the when you use the television as a babysitter or technology as a babysitter, that's the improper use of the technology, and the technology isn't evil. It's the way that it's used.
Right, and it's I know, you know, all parents, we're all busy, and we all would like to have some time to ourselves. We do too. My wife and I do too. But believe it or not, they learn how to occupy themselves if they're not used to having television occupy them. They can play on their own. It just takes some time to transition from being addicted to screens to being able to play on your own without screens.
Yes. Well, now you recommend that you take the kids outside in the neighborhood every day.
Well, we live, you know, some of our listeners are in climates where it becomes a little more difficult to do that. We live in Northern California. We've got amazing weather. Absolutely, we're out there every day. We're usually in the front of our home rather than the back because we're trying to swim upstream. We're trying to change our neighborhood culture, and we have to some extent, which I can tell you about later. But we need to demonstrate to people that we're outside, we're playing, we're having fun, and that they should do it too.
Yes. Yes, I think that's a wonderful, and I certainly felt that way when my children were growing up, and I noticed you have a child named Nico, mm-hmm. and I also have a son named Nico. He's a twin. And,
great.
Yeah, it's a great name. And that they're comfortable in the neighborhood and that they play. Now, I was perhaps pretty radical, but I provided a mud hole and let them play in the dirt and get grubby and be barefoot, and I didn't go rushing out there with coats and things unless they said, gee, I'm cold, you know. And they never wanted to come in. They loved it. Oh, and going to the coast, going to the beach, all of these wonderful things that you can do out of doors with children that is not being provided in these plastic, is what I call them, well manicured environments,
mm-hmm.
and with poison plants. I know a child died from roasting a hot dog when he decided he was going to leave home. You know, decided a joke kind of thing, and he roasted a hot dog, and the plant that he used was poisonous. Well,
okay.
Why do we have those plants around schools and children? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I will say this though. I think that's awful, but I think that we need to start with our kids right where they live, and figure out a way to embrace where we live. One way in which I'm a little bit have a little bit different point of view than some folks out there who are interested in kids being outside is. I don't believe that we should place a high priority on throwing our kids in the car and driving them across town or driving an hour away to a state park. I mean, that's nice once in a while, but if that's all the nature that they have, then it's not a habit. It's not a place that they can call their own. It's not
right.
A place that they can assert their own individuality in. It's unfortunate. Not everybody lives in a place that has great nature, but it's where they live. And we need to figure out, find the hidden treasures wherever we live.
So create a third place for kids.
Yes. Most people, I just became aware in the last couple of years of this term third place. But it's interesting. There's a sociologist by the name of Ray Oldenburg who wrote a book called The Great Good Place. And he writes about the fact that human beings throughout history have had three places in their lives where they have some sort of social network, some sort of social group that they are with. The first place in their lives, of course, is their home, and that's where their family is. The second place in their lives is their workplace or their school. And then there's this third place, which is a place that isn't so formal. It's a place where you can just show up, see people you know, chat with them, enjoy yourself, and then leave when you want. So you show up when you want, you leave when you want, and there are people there who you enjoy being with. And, for adults, it's a place like the Cheers Bar, a cafe down the corner. For kids, when I was a kid, we had a street between my house and another house where pretty much all the time, at least in the summer and when the weather was decent, there were baseball games, softball games or street hockey or two-hand tag football. There was just kids were there. They would just show up and go, and they would know that there would be somebody there. Today, if you think, for most kids, do they have a third place? And your first answer might be no, but actually they do. It's Facebook or it's some other social network. So kids need it. kids want to go, especially when they get to a certain age. They want to run into people they know and chat with them and spend time with them. But kids are spending hours a day on Facebook, and I just believe the kids need a physical third place in their lives. So I very much believe that people should either build in their yard, in a neighbor's yard, or in a vacant lot. There aren't too many these days. Right in the block where the kids live, they should have a place where they can go to and do something interesting and be with people they want to be with.
I agree with you. I wholeheartedly agree with you. Let it be. Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
Now you say make your yard into a sought-after neighborhood hangout, and that there are five must-have characteristics of a popular neighborhood hangout.
I'll try to recite them from memory. For one, it has to be visible, because, you know, like I said before, we're trying to change culture here, and so we need people who aren't, you know, who haven't converted and aren't playing outside every day. We want them to see it. We want it to be accessible, which is related to visible, but it can be visible through a chain link fence. It has to be accessible. You have to be able to get there easily. So backyards, especially where I live in Northern California, are not good places for a third place. The backyards in Northern California have privacy fences all around,
right.
And the fences are there so that people can't see, so people can't get there. So we really need to do it in our front yard and right by our street or in our street. So that's two. So accessibility, visibility. Another one is critical mass. It has to be, it has to have enough interesting features so that kids will want to be there every day for a long time. Not only one kid, but kids of different ages. So, for instance, down the street from us, a couple houses down, we have a family that has a boy who's, let's say, a boy who's 9, a girl who's 7, and a boy who's 5. Well, the 9-year-old doesn't want to play in the sandbox. He wants to play basketball. The 5-year-old doesn't want to play basketball. He wants to play in the sandbox. So we need different features. If we want that whole family to come over, we need different features for them. Another one is comfort. Kids need to be, as you know, they're not going to be running around all the time. They need to sit down once in a while. And especially parents, if parents are taking kids around, if there's a sandbox, they'll stand over the kid for 5 or 10 minutes playing the sandbox. But if they have a place to sit, and you know, if there's another parent there, they'll sit for an hour very easily. And I think I remembered all five. I'm remembering that the last one is just fun things to do.
Right. That's what you said. Fun for multiple ages.
Yeah.
Comfortable. Visible.
This goes back to the idea in the Montessori philosophy of a prepared environment. It'd be great if kids took any random piece of land and made it their own, but we can encourage that. We can afford that by putting some great things out there that kids can take and run with.
That's right. A prepared environment for multi-ages. And that's also Montessori.
Right, right. So kids who, you know, 2 or 3 year old kids in our front yard, we have a water fountain that is specially chosen so the kids can splash their hands in it. It's very, very low. It doesn't have any sharp edges. We have a play river. We have a sandbox. That's for the toddlers. Kids who get a little older, they like to have a fort. They like to climb. So we have a lot of climbing possibilities. Then older kids, they like forts too, but they like a fort where they can actually be private. They can be away from parents.
Right.
They like a little technology. So, and we have some technology outside in our home as well. We have the ability to turn on music. We have the ability to project video onto a screen. So, and we have a lot of outlets for creative expression. We have a whiteboard, which is something that toddlers don't do as much, but the older kids, when they start to be able to write, they do a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all very important. It all comes together.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful, just wonderful, Mike. Now, you also say give children ownership, at least somewhat, of the look of their front and backyards.
Yes, I think that, you know, you drive. We live in a nice what most people consider to be a nice town, kind of a suburb of San Francisco. And you drive through one of these places, and you know, you look at lawn after lawn after lawn, and the, you know, you have the front facades of houses, and from one point of view, it's beautiful, it's peaceful. But when I look at it, I think, God, where are the kids, and mm-hmm. why aren't kids asserting themselves and showing people that this is where they live? You know, if kids don't assert ownership over a place, they're not very proud of it. They're not very invested in it. They're not having very deep play there. And that, to me, is the most important thing as a father. I want my kids, I want neighbor kids to really put their stake in the ground and you know, figuratively say, this is my place, and I've made it into my own. Very much, I think kids should build forts. And people call it defacing. I like kids to draw. I like kids to paint. It may decrease the curb value of your home, but there are ways you can do it. For instance, we have whiteboard along one fence line of our front yard, and so we wipe it off. You know, and we keep out a box of pens. We tell anybody in the neighborhood, you can come over anytime and draw, and they do, and that's easy to wipe off. This year. I can't tell you exactly because I don't have it all figured out, but we're going to experiment with having our kids paint our house because it's that important to me, and they're not going to paint it all one color, I can assure you.
Right. Involving them in our lives is so important. So just like if you're going to paint your house, letting them help you paint, that's just really important. Involving them in our lives is so important rather than always finding some distraction. Mm-hmm. So that they don't have to, you know, so that they're not interacting with us. I was also thinking of sidewalk chalk as something else that you can use, and also then, you know, you can rinse it off. And we would do a bucket full of water with a large paintbrush on a sunny day and let a toddler or a child up to 6 or 7 paint on the sidewalk with that water and the brush, and then the sun, of course, dries it up, and oh, they're just fascinated with it. So there are a lot of things that you can do, and it's true that our society is not very friendly to children.
It's funny, all these and I don't want to belittle all these suburban parents out there, or parents who are saying, oh, we're doing this for our children, we're living our lives for our children. Well, you know, children wouldn't choose these places to live that are so dead and boring. You know, children haven't chosen, you know, what the yard looks like and what the features in the yard. If we make decisions thinking of what the children would like, we end up with a lot of different conclusions, and I think parents really need to think about that.
And also, when in just the whole process of doing that, you're introducing democracy and dialogue into the mix. Mm-hmm. What would you like? And it's all connected. And it's wonderful what you're doing, and I just want people to listen, and I want schools especially to listen.
Well, you know, let me say a word about that. So, absolutely, I believe that recess is very important, and it's dying. I hope it's not going away, but it's dying in a lot of school districts. They think for some reason that they can just cram more and more instruction and increase their test scores, and they don't realize how good recess is for the whole child. You know, another thing, actually one of my biggest issues with schools is homework. It is a fact that of all the studies, and there have been literally thousands of studies done to try to establish some relationship, some correlation between homework in elementary school and academic achievement in elementary school, there's never been any relationship established. So we have this, what I think is an insane notion that we should keep cramming homework down elementary school kids' throats, even though we haven't shown that there's any benefit. So the school district that we live in, It has very high test scores, just like everybody else, every other school around us. But our school is unique in that the principal has a low or no homework policy. He doesn't have a zero homework policy because he doesn't feel he can force his teachers to give zero homework. But my first grader has not had any homework yet. He's almost done with his first grade.
That's great.
And so that really helps our family life. And they do tell kids, please, we want you to read every night. And my son Marco reads on his own because he loves it.
Yes.
He's really interested in it.
Yeah.
So schools are a part of the equation. But I believe when kids come home from school, especially elementary school kids, they shouldn't be doing schoolwork. They should be doing other things that contribute to their development. Academics is just a part of it.
Yes, and you know, if you don't have movement, if you take away recess so there's no movement, and all the child growth and development experts agree with this, then you are doing a disservice to the child's academics, because the brain needs that movement. The brain needs that movement to develop properly. And in a Montessori school, there isn't homework, you know, because you make the choice. The child has the choice to do all of their work during work period.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they choose not to do that, then they'll take their work home. But that, they've made the choice. They made the choice to play chess with Billy. And so they're going to take their work home. And I'm talking about elementary school kids, you know, in fourth, fifth grade now, not
right.
First grade.
The higher elementary.
Higher elementary. But still, you know, taking choice away from children, the ability to talk and reason, creative thinking, critical thinking, all of that we are losing. And parents are not up in arms that these schools are not listening to the child growth and development experts. They are not listening to the experts in education either. Business entrepreneurs are guiding our schools, our public schools. It's really...
Well, I don't know quite where the impetus is coming from, because... I could tell you a story. I'm actually an ex-entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, and I know a lot of people like me who think it's insane as well. I don't know exactly where the push is coming from. One thing you can say, I guess, is that if we keep kids institutionalized in school for longer periods of time, maybe there'll be more jobs. Maybe that's where it's coming from. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, well, I am, because I've done all the research, but we're not going to go there. Well, I will just tell you, you know, check out ALEC, ALEC, and you'll find out that these for-profit, private companies are taking over public education. And bashing teachers. I know that, you know, I have a great deal of respect for Google, and they would not agree with this. They were Montessori students. They know that even in a working environment, that you need free time, you need open space, you need leisure time. Or Dan Pink, if you look at Dan Pink's work, he tells you that carrots and sticks don't work. And yet that's what we're doing. You know, we're offering rewards. Montessori knew that 100 years ago. Well, now Dan Pink has the evidence for that. Or Sir Ken Robinson talks about, you know, how we're killing creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the experts. But it's these private... You know, when I say entrepreneur, I'm not putting down being an entrepreneur.
Right.
I am talking about people who are in the business to make profit. And they see that funds for public education is like a cash cow. And the testing companies who are linked to the textbook companies, who, you know, I don't know why people are not doing their own research from the original sources, especially with the computer. Why we need these textbooks, except maybe for math, they are making a killing, and they are making a killing off of the backs of teachers and the future of our children. And I'm sorry to preach at you, Mike, but
That's an important topic, that's for sure.
Oh, it is. And I'm just glad that you're in an area and where you can you have the choice to find that for your children, and I know I did too. And I just wasn't going to sacrifice my children to that system. It all started, really, with Reagan in the 80s. We had a wonderful system here in California in the 60s and in the early 70s. And everything was free, even university. Well, you talk about overscheduling kids. And you want to talk about that, overscheduling
sure.
kids?
Sure, absolutely. I think that there's so many things I could criticize about overscheduling. I think fundamentally, kids don't need to go to all these enrichment activities. This is not about the child's life today. This is about some parents' conception of what is going to be good for their kids later on in their lives. And I just wish parents would think more about children as people today rather than as potential adults decades from now.
Yeah.
It's not healthy to be for kids to be driving around in cars so much, being strapped in. It's not healthy for kids to be under adults' direct supervision so much, especially after a school day for kids who are in school. To be in school all day and then to be in activities up until dinner and sometimes even after dinner if they're in organized sports. They need freedom. They need to think for themselves. And a scheduled life is a very hectic life. And childhood should be fun. It should be relaxing. It should be a time when kids can be creative and really think for themselves rather than a time when they're under direct supervision all hours of the day.
Right. Direct. There's the term, direct supervision. And there we would both agree. Well, now, tell our listeners how they can get your book, Playberhood, Turn Your Neighborhood into a Place for Play.
Well, it is available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. It's available for international customers. I don't know if anybody international is going to be listening, but through the bookdepository.com with free shipping anywhere in the world. Some local bookstores are starting to pick it up, so there's in Northern California I have good relationships with bookstores here, so Kepler's Books in Menlo Park and the Reading Bug in San Carlos, and I hope other independent bookstores will pick it up as well in the future. Very soon, within the next week or two, I will also have a Kindle version and an iBooks and a Nook version, so electronic versions of the book will be available as well.
Wonderful. You've got all the bases covered. So
I hope so. Well, I hope we get more physical bookstores out there to carry it. But if you want it and you don't mind the electronic or the online guides, it's pretty easy to get.
Right. So a person could just Google Playberhood, Turn Your Neighborhood into a Place for Play.
Or just Playberhood. They'll get to the website and they'll have a link
right
there.
Right. That's what I was going to say. I just really enjoy your website.
Thank you. And
that's the playberhood.com. So our listeners get to hear
and,
that.
And Playborhood, or if you prefer the British spelling, that works too.
Okay. I do think that we do have some listeners who are not in America. So perhaps I'm glad that you put all of the information out there that a person would need to know. Well, unless there's something you would like to add.
Well, it'd be nice to sum things up. I'll try to sum things up by saying, that this is not just a theoretical wish. Playberhood is about parents, helping parents to learn about other communities where kids are out playing, and then to give them a set of tools where they can make it happen, and to make their neighborhood into a vibrant place where kids can play outside every day. So if you think you might be interested in it, Playberhood, the book and the website. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I very much enjoyed this conversation with Mike Lanza. And as I said during the interview, I don't feel as strongly as he does about technology, and I do prefer supervised play. That means a person steps out of the way and follows the child, but you're there watching, but you follow the lead of the child or the children. Otherwise, I feel that the strongest personality dominates, and I feel that this is there's proof for this in the whole free school movement that was started in England. In the 70s, as I said in the interview, in Southern California, we created spaces called adventure playgrounds because we saw that all of the open space was being eaten up by developers. But that soon disappeared. And I'm just so happy, as I told Mike in the interview, to see this happening again in a new way. Play is the child's work. And it's so disheartening to hear that many public schools are not affording children the time to play and for recess and the arts. Even in kindergarten, even though all the experts, as I said, in child growth and development, tell us that play and movement is the way that the brain develops, and that is all being confirmed by neuroscience. It is so sad, and it makes me angry, because creative imagination and movement are two essential ingredients in the development of the child. So, a website from Mike Lanza is just playberhood.com. Your HTTPs and then playberhood.com, and it will get you there. And you can listen and download free anytime at this website. And please join us on Facebook. Education Now has a Facebook page, or on our Google Plus page, to leave comments and join the conversation. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education. Education Now podcasts are listed on the American Montessori Society website at www.amshq.org. Look in the events pages under local events. Well, I'm sending you all much cosmic love and saying goodbye for now. This is Athena Melville for Education Now.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.